5 degrees in Racine, 49 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Stay with us. The Thursday morning show will be coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am happy to have with me in the studios today our good friend Nan Calvert, paying her monthly visit to the morning show. We are all supposed to have with us on the phone Todd Burlett, who is with the Mid-Continent chapter of the Dark Sky International Group, which works against what is known as light pollution. Unfortunately, we're having trouble connecting with Mr. Burlett, and if we are unable to connect with him ultimately today, we'll hope that we can have a conversation with him on another occasion. But in the meantime, this is an interesting topic which Nan Calvert herself has been exploring, and she will have some interesting thoughts to share as well. And in the time that remains in the hour, then, I'm going to give you a little taste of a really fascinating interview that I just recorded a couple of days ago, an interview that will be airing next week in its entirety. We'll tell you about that in just a little bit. But first, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
All right. At the moment, you are the sole guest of the morning show, which is not what we envisioned. But anyway, we'll see if we can still connect with the gentleman that you lined up for today, Todd Burlett.
Yes, hopefully.
But in the meantime, tell our listeners first of all, kind of in general, how much you have thought about the whole issue of what we call light pollution, and then what kind of stirred your additional or added interest lately?
Well, I've actually thought about it quite a bit over the years, especially since I live out in the county where you can still see the stars at night. And I know that a lot of people are unable to do so simply because the light on the surface of the earth is too much, and it is decreasing the dark skies that we need. Now, most people don't think about anything needing a dark sky, but in point of fact, we do have circadian rhythms. Every living thing has a circadian rhythm that's hardwired into its biology, and that allows it to survive and thrive and have a quality life. But, you know, since the electric light was invented, things have changed quite a bit. And certainly, absolutely, over the last, 25, 50 years, the light on the surface of the earth has exploded exponentially. There are a lot more humans. There are a lot, more places that require illumination, or at least want illumination, and it has a very negative impact. Humans have always been afraid of the dark, sometimes for good reason, but often for not very many good reasons. Mm-hmm. And so we always try to dispel the darkness with some sort of light. But unfortunately now it's coming back to hit us really hard in many different ways.
Let's circle back to one thing that you talked about, which I suspect a lot of our listeners will know about, but maybe not everybody is acquainted with this concept of circadian rhythms. Mm-hmm. and the fact that that is something that is part of the human experience, but the experience of probably most creatures on Earth. Mm-hmm. Explain what that term is actually all about, and then what this whole notion of darkness versus light pollution has to do with that.
Right. So, you know, a long time ago when people lived closer to the land, and they certainly were beholden to the weather and all kinds of things, they arose with the sun and they went to bed as the sun set. But things have changed dramatically. And that really is sort of biologically, physiologically, our rhythm to get up when the sun rises and to pack it in when the sun starts to go down. But of course, things have changed dramatically. And so we don't pay attention to that very much anymore. Mm-hmm. And certainly with the advent of all of our devices in whatever size and shape they take, you know, we take them to bed with us, and you know, it might be dark in the house and it's dark outside, but our brains are seeing that light on the screen, the images on the screen. And so much research has been done in terms of how that affects sleep and quality of sleep and the rhythm that your body naturally takes. And we know now that it has very detrimental health effects. So, poor sleep quality affects everything. It can affect depression. It can affect your weight. It can affect your cardiovascular status, and on and on. Now, when you think about other living things being impacted by light and the lack of darkness, it holds the same for them, only in a much bigger way. So we have all kinds of nocturnal animals that absolutely depend on the dark for their survival. They did not develop, they did not evolve to live in a world that is bright all of the time. And so it disrupts their hunting and the success of their hunts. It confuses insects. You know, they don't know quite what to do, and so they don't pollinate the way that they're supposed to, our native insects. And then, of course, if native plants aren't being pollinated, they don't survive either. So, yes, there is a tragic decline of all manner of species on the earth due to climate change and degraded and destroyed habitats and all kinds of toxins in the world, in soil and air and in water. But also, it's the lack of darkness and the overabundance of light that has an enormous negative impact on all kinds of things, human, plant, and other animals.
I don't think in your introductory remarks you mentioned the really interesting book that uh, you you recently came across, which also kind of sparked some of your new interest and concern about this. Tell our listeners about this.
Yeah, I was lucky to tune into an interview of an author by the name of Johan Elkeloff, and he's from Sweden. And he's written a new book called The Darkness Manifesto. He's a scientist. He's researched light pollution for a very long time. He also has a special interest in bats. That led him to, investigate the impact of an increasingly bright world on all manner of species. And it's called The Darkness Manifesto. And I highly recommend everybody go to the library or go to your favorite bookseller and get a copy and read it. It certainly will be eye-opening and mind-opening.
For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today with our good friend Nan Calvert, paying her monthly visit to the morning show here on WGTD. And we are hoping in a few moments to connect with Todd Burlett, whom she engaged to be a special guest with us. He is with an organization called Dark Sky International. Nan, as we're trying to work that out, maybe you could just say a quick word about the general concept of light pollution and of trying to do something about this increase in a sense, unnecessary and excessive light.
Sure. If you live in the city, it's hard to see because the city is bright all of the time. But if you go out to a less inhabited area, it's darker. It's much darker. You can see the stars. And then when you turn around and look at the horizon, you can see pockets of light emanating up into the sky from car dealerships, from streetlights, from malls, and all kinds of things. And that light is unnecessary. It's light pollution. It's extraneous light. And so it also comes from our own properties when we install lights all over the place. The good thing about light pollution is that we created it, but we can also do something about it. And that's what we want to talk about today, the trouble with light pollution, the difficulties that it causes, but also what we can do about it. And it's actually relatively easy.
Very good. So we're going to take a quick break and try to connect with Todd Burlett once again to get his input on expertise. So we'll be right back. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1. And I'm happy to say that now on the phone line, we have Todd Burlett with us, who is with, I understand, the Mid-Continent chapter of Dark Sky International, who is going to join our conversation about this thing called light pollution. Todd Burlett, are you still there?
I am indeed. Good morning.
Glad that we are joining with you. Where are you talking to us from? Where are you located this morning?
I'm from a suburb of Minneapolis-St. Paul, a northwest suburb called Maple Grove, right on the edge of the metro area.
Very good. Tell us a little bit about where you're from originally, if that is your native neck of the woods, so to speak, and kind of your professional path, which ultimately led you to your involvement with Dark Sky International.
Yeah, absolutely. So born and raised here, grew up just a little bit west of here on the western edge of the metro area, little town called Mound, and grew up there in the 60s and 70s. And back then, the only light pollution that I had to worry about was that the single street light that was in the corner of the front yard. And as a budding would-be astronomer, I had a little cardboard tube telescope straight out of the Sears catalog. And my solution to light pollution back then was to pick up this little cardboard tube, flimsy-legged telescope and walk it into the backyard. Light pollution was solved. So I got interested in the sky. I think I was about 6 years old, and my dad took me out in the backyard, and he pointed up at a red dot in the sky and said, that was Mars. And it blew me away that I could see another planet right from my own backyard, and I was hooked. So off to college I went, and fully intended to be a professional astronomer. Got most of the way through college and realized that was not the greatest career choice for me. The advanced math just kind of didn't work in my brain. The physics was great. I loved that, so came out of college with a physics degree, and then looked around and tried to figure out, well, what do I do with a physics degree if I'm not going to be in astronomy? So I did the next best thing and went into aerospace. And so I spent the next 37 years as an engineer in a major aerospace corporation where I did get to go into space a little bit. And so that was my fallback.
Wow. So it is as somebody who has enjoyed looking at the night sky for a long time that you came to your first acquaintance with this idea of light pollution. So tell us at what point it became a rather sort of central concern and focus of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. It actually gelled for me, it has to be at least 20 years ago. I had a brother that lived in Chicago suburbs, if you're familiar with Hinsdale at all. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting in his backyard. It was Thanksgiving, and we were all sitting outside, and it was about midnight, so well after dark. And as I often do, I looked up at the sky to take in the beautiful night sky, and instead of seeing this dark vault overhead sprinkled with stars, what I saw was dark blue with maybe a half dozen stars that I could pick out, some of the very brightest stars in the sky. And I realized then that what I was looking at was a sky that had been brightened by the cumulative light of the entire population of the region. So their street lights, their house lights, industrial and commercial lights, and so on. And it hit me that the 9 million residents of the Chicago region had lost the ability to step outside with their kids at night and to look up and see that beautiful night sky, see that Milky Way, see the aurora. And that's when I decided that I needed to get involved and something needed to be done. Hmm. So that's what launched me on this journey.
Hmm. So tell our listeners a little bit about this organization of which you are a member, and namely Dark Sky International. Tell us kind of the nature of this organization and also the scope of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So until late last year, the organization was known as the International Dark Sky Association, or IDA. So some of your listeners may be familiar with that name. It's the same organization, same everything, but they decided that was a bit of a mouthful, so they rebranded themselves, and in fact, they're still kind of rolling that out. You'll still find some IDA language on their website and other places. But otherwise, they've largely completed rebranding themselves as Dark Sky International, so it's just a little bit easier to pronounce. They started back in 1988, a group of astronomers working down in Flagstaff, Arizona, were increasingly concerned about how bright the city lights were at some of the nation's research telescopes. And so they started working with the city and the residents to figure out how we could have our cake and eat it too, how we could have that light at night that we value and need and serves a purpose, while also helping keep the dark sky dark so that the researchers could do what they needed to do up on Mount Lemmon and other places, and then also keep the dark sky dark for all the other life forms on Earth, including in humans, that not just value but actually need that dark sky. So that's the parent organization that we are a part of. Our local organization here is called Starry Skies North, and we started about a decade ago up in Duluth, Minnesota, and 3 years ago we expanded statewide, which is when I got involved actively with the local chapter. And when we started the local chapter, when it went statewide, we looked around the region at surrounding states to figure out who we could collaborate with, who we could share best practices with, share resources with. And there weren't a lot out there. There was a chapter over in South Dakota, but that was it. North Dakota, there was no chapter. Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, and even the provinces north of us in Canada. So we were a little bit of a voice in the wilderness, and we thought this part of the country is so aware of the value of the dark sky. We're so aware and appreciative of those natural outdoor environments, both day and night, you know, hunting, fishing, recreating in the outdoors. And we thought, we can't be the only ones that are interested in the dark sky. It's just that no one has stood up and started anything formally. So we did. We decided to launch the Mid-Continent Chapter Incubator, which has a goal of starting chapters and supporting chapters and individuals across this entire six-state, two-province region. And so that's why we're both the Minnesota and Mid-Continent chapter of Dark Sky International. And that's working. We're very excited to have played at least a small role in launching Michigan's Dark Sky chapter. And our near-term goals are to start chapters in both Wisconsin and Iowa. So we're looking forward to getting those off the ground next year.
And what's involved in starting a chapter? I mean, for instance, to get something going here in the state of Wisconsin, what would it take?
Very little. The bar to become a chapter of Dark Sky International is you need 5 people that agree to come together, form a board, assign some executives, and then start meeting regularly and then doing outreach. And I can tell you from personal experience, there's hardly a week that goes by that I'm not getting a phone, an email, a text from someone in Wisconsin that says, hey, what can I do? How can I help? How can I get involved? So it's really just a matter of having the bandwidth on my part to reach out, pull all of those people together from across the state and get them to sit down and decide that they're going to start doing this more formally.
For those of you just joining us, we are speaking right now via telephone with Todd Burlett, who is with the Mid-Continent chapter of Dark Sky International that is working on the issue, the problem of light pollution, of excessive human-made light, which can have all kinds of detrimental effects that most of us are scarcely aware of at all. Todd, because we spend a lot of time in Nan's programs on the morning show talking about the natural environment and in particular the impact on the creatures with which we share the planet, I think it would be good for us to spend a few minutes talking about the way in which light pollution is harmful to wildlife and ecosystems. And I know there's a whole page on the Dark Sky International website that explores this in some detail. And Nan got us started before you were able to join us. But tell us more about the way in which light pollution has an adverse effect on all kinds of living creatures all around us, and how that in turn can be harmful not only to them, but ultimately to us.
Oh, what a wonderful question. Yeah, and the difficult problem in answering that question is knowing when to stop, because the impacts are legion. I sometimes start at the very bottom of the food chain and think about water quality. It's a great place to start. So we think about the impact on algae and the things that eat algae, and what light pollution does to debalance that. So as your listeners may know, algae is a plant. It's a floating aquatic plant, sometimes in the water column, sometimes on the surface. And as a plant, it uses light in order to create energy that it uses to live and reproduce. And so adding more light, especially this blue bright light, that blue light has more energy because it's a shorter wavelength than red light or green light does. So adding that artificial light at night to a body of water, be that a pond, a lake, a stream, what have you, is going to provide more energy for the growth and reproduction of algae. So you've got more algae generally in those bodies of water that are exposed to light pollution. And, of course, light pollution doesn't stop at the surface of the water. It penetrates deep down into the water, just like daylight would. And that penetrating of the light into the water disrupts the things that would normally eat the algae. So we call those zooplankton. They're the tiny little critters that spend their day deep in the water because they don't like bright light, because that's when their predators can see them and eat them. So during the day when there's a lot of light present, they hide down in the deep water. And then at night, as light starts to leave the world, they'll come up, and that's when they're feeding on those algae. And then when day comes, of course, then they're going back down. But with light pollution, of course, they see that light, they think it's still daytime, and so they're not going to come up and feed on that algae. So you've got two things going on. You've got more algae growing, and you've got fewer things eating that algae, and that's leading to increased algae production in our lakes and rivers. In fact, last year, for the first time, we did see a toxic algae bloom in Lake Superior. So that's at the bottom of the food chain. And then, of course, what that means is, from the standpoint of the rest of the food chain, the things that eat the zooplankton aren't finding as many zooplankton to eat because they're hiding down in the bottom. And they're also not thriving as well because they're not coming up getting that nice meal of algae. So that has impacts on the entire food chain. But then, and that of course is an indirect impact. There's just a little bit less food for everything up and down the food chain. But then you can talk about the direct impact on things like fish, including sport fish, the fish that we like, such as bass or walleye. And bass, when they're exposed to artificial light at night, stay in this hyper alert mode, this fight or flight mode, because they're expecting to be able to rest at night. They can't rest under this bright blue light any better than we can. And so they're actually spending their night in this hyper alert mode. And so they're not getting the rest that they need. They're not getting the recovery that their bodies need. And of course, they're burning through their calorie store. So they've got less energy available to go out and hunt it during the day, less energy to be raising their young. And so you're seeing reduced bass populations. Walleye is kind of a similar problem, but walleyes are a predator fish, and so they eat by hunting other little fish. But because we've added light to their environment, now their prey can see the walleye coming And so it's that much harder for walleye to catch that prey. And so we've disrupted that predator-prey balance and made it harder for walleye, again, to thrive. So that's impacting our walleye
Fascinating.
Population.
And, of course, that's such a good example of a completely inadvertent action on our part, I mean, with completely unintended consequences that would also be so easy to miss if someone wasn't studying this very, very carefully. I know the list of examples is endless, but I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about a really poignant photograph that is on the website of Dark Sky International, in which we see a hatching loggerhead sea turtle on the pavement, and there is some kind of light pole illuminated in the distance ahead of this little turtle, and it is trying to highlight one more problem with excess human-made light. Can you explain to our listeners about that?
Yeah, that's a really iconic photo, and perhaps one of the more common stories that some of your listeners may have heard, which is this issue of sea turtles getting turned around. So from an evolutionary standpoint, you think about light on Earth, and at night, of course, the only light on Earth for billions of years was the moon. And the moon would, of course, be shining on the environment, and the ocean for a hatching sea turtle would be brighter than the land behind them, because the land behind them, of course, has trees and grass that absorb and reflect that light. Whereas if you've ever stood on a shore at night, and everyone has seen this, it's dark behind you, but that water, especially towards the time of the full moon, which is when many turtles hatch, is going to be brighter. You've got that speckle on the water. And, of course, you've got much more access to the night sky. So the night sky, due to the full moon, is going to be brighter than the foliage behind you. And so from an evolutionary standpoint, turtles emerging at night, which is when they do come out, would come out and they would see which direction was brighter, and they would head towards the full moon or the brighter area, because that's where the water was. So turtles have trained, become ingrained in their DNA, quite literally, that bright is the way to go when you're a baby turtle and you're coming out of that sand.
Hmm.
About 100 years ago, humans came along and really started to brighten our environment with the Edison bulb and, of course, now compact fluorescence and LEDs. And now the full moon is no longer the brightest thing in the sky. And so the turtles, they don't know that we have changed the planet. And so they are turning around as they have for hundreds of millions of years, and they're heading for the brightest thing, which unfortunately is the local street light. And so sea turtles get a lot of the press on this, rightfully so, but I've been talking to the members of the DNR, the Minnesota Non-Game Wildlife DNR, and they tell me it's not just the sea turtles, it's also the freshwater turtles that we have here in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Same problem. These turtles are emerging. They've evolved to head towards the bright thing, which is presumably the water, and instead they're crossing roads and ending up under these bright lights. And so sea turtles are kind of the poster child, if they will, but we have a very direct impact on our turtles right here in the upper Midwest.
Mm. One thing that is also mentioned on your website about this, which had not occurred to me at all, is that yet another environmental concern when it comes to an excessive amount of human-made light is just the whole matter of wasted energy, of energy consumption, that we are consuming far more energy than is necessary. And that is a bad thing for everybody, except, I suppose, those who are selling us electricity. But tell us to what extent this is a problem. I mean, and is this a problem that we can quantify in terms of excess energy used for more light than we really need?
Yes, we can quantify it. And generally speaking, the number that the Dark Sky International has used is somewhere around 30 to 35% of outdoor lighting at night serves no purpose. In other words, it's being shown directly up into the sky, or worse even, sometimes being shown horizontally off of these 30, 40, 60-foot high poles and shining directly into people's bedrooms at night and disrupting their lives. And that works out to, if we were going to replace that energy or the carbon emissions that are used to create that energy, we'd have to plant 600 million trees a year just to make up for the light that we are completely wasting, that serves no purpose, that doesn't light up the ground, that doesn't help us feel safer or serve any other purpose. There was a report that just came out this year from the Department of Energy that points out that it's even worse than that. And the report from the Department of Energy is that less than 1% of outdoor lighting at night serves any purpose at all. And the great example of that, of course, is that lonely light pole in the middle of nowhere that's on from sunset to sunrise. And most of that night, there's just no one that's driving by. There's no one that's walking by. And so that light is blazing night after night without providing any value. That light isn't serving a purpose. And it's a great example of how we could very easily reduce our energy use. We could increase our energy independence by just doing simple things like putting those lights on motion detectors so that light is off at night until it's needed. And then when a car approaches, a pedestrian approaches, LED lights are great because they're instant on. That light snaps on, provides the light that we need in order to move through that intersection safely, and then we move on and that light goes back off again. So 99% of outdoor lighting at night, that's just a mind-boggling number in terms of what we could save in energy, in terms of climate-changing carbon emissions.
I wanted to ask you what the path forward is in terms of finding some solutions for this and of, for one thing, kind of breaking us out of deeply ingrained habits and previous practice. And you've already started us down that road. Tell us about some of the other initiatives that Dark Sky International is undertaking in terms of trying to combat this, trying to reverse this at least.
Right. Most of what we encounter is just a complete lack of awareness on people's part. Not because people aren't intelligent; people are very intelligent, but it's just not something that it gets a lot of press, a lot of awareness. And once you start to talk to people about some of the things that we've been talking about here, the environmental impacts, the human health and wellness impacts, the climate change impacts, and on and on. If you'll excuse the pun, the light bulb goes off in their head. And I can't tell you how many times people have turned around and said to me, I had no idea. And so we start with education, just raising awareness, such as what we're doing on this program. We get out across the state and are going to county fairs, state fairs. Just this last weekend, we were at three different locations across the state. We happened to be in the middle of our annual Celebrate the Night week up in Duluth Superior. We've got a big premiere event this year, where this afternoon, in fact, when we're done here, I'm jumping in the car and driving up north. And we're going to be launching what we call the Dark Sky Friendly Business Initiative, where we're recognizing businesses that get it. They've become aware of the issue. They've become aware of the fact that they, as individuals, as ma and pa companies, or as multinational corporations, can make a real difference starting tonight if they think about how they light their spaces differently. We were also down here at the State Fair and then Monarch Festival. Minneapolis has a great Monarch Festival every year that coincides with when the Monarchs are getting ready to head down south. So it's a lot of public outreach to reach people where they are in their libraries, in their schools, in their communities, talking to civic organizations, Rotary clubs, city councils, and whatnot, and just raising the awareness. And again, as I stated, there's just their eyes just pop open when they realize how serious the issue is and how easy it is to solve. You know, if there's a silver lining to light pollution, it's that light doesn't persist in the environment. Of course, we're all watching what's happening with climate change, and scientists tell us, you know, it will be decades or centuries before we're able to stop and reverse the warming of the planet. And, of course, there's a lot in the news these days about these forever chemicals that we've put in the environment or the microplastics. And all of those are serious environmental issues that are going to be really hard to resolve in the environment because they persist. Light pollution, conversely, is the easiest problem to solve because it doesn't persist in the environment. You turn that light off, that harm stops. Now, the damage that we've done will take time to resolve itself, so the imbalances that we've created in predator-prey relationships that we've talked about will take time to work out. But at least the light pollution itself, the damage, stops as soon as you hit that light switch. Mm.
I was glad that you mentioned city councils in that list of people you talk to, because, of course, it's one thing for just, in a sense, ordinary people, ordinary citizens to be concerned. But, of course, it is really with city councils that a lot of, and city administrators, that a lot of these kind of decisions get made. I also wanted to ask about the matter of changing the way we do new construction versus undoing what has already been constructed. I mean, for instance, taking streetlights that are already there and either removing them or changing them into something else. I suspect that that's, in a sense, a little tougher nut to crack, because we're probably talking about considerable cost, but I suspect you would argue that that is considerable cost that is well worth it.
Right. Yeah. So just a word on the considerable cost. You're right. You know, that is one of the key impediments to changing out all of these lights. But we often point out that, you know, of course, you've got that one-time upfront cost. But then if you're doing things like lowering the light level to where you actually need it rather than, you know, what you were sold out of a lighting catalog, and you're thinking about putting things on timers or motion detectors, you're going to recoup those costs in the form of lower energy bills, whether we're talking about a municipality or your household budget, over time. And these changes will actually pay for themselves. But coming back to your question about new construction, you're absolutely right. And again, it gets back to education, because so many contractors, so many members of city councils just have never been trained in the issue of light pollution. So they're not aware of these impacts that we've been talking about, and it's just not on their radar screen. So by talking to the city councils, by talking to the city engineers, by talking to the lighting contractors, the lighting designers and the architects about light pollution and how the decisions that they're making during those design phases can have a direct impact on the future light pollution and the future health of that community, whether it's the human health or the health of the critters that we share our communities with. If they just make more informed decisions about how they're going to be lighting those spaces. And there are wonderful tools out there now that can help you design those spaces, just an ever-increasing number of lighting solutions, so lighting fixtures that are well-shielded, that have those warmer color temperatures that get us away from those bright blue LEDs that are really the most harmful. And so it's really about educating those organizations. And that's something that the Dark Sky International and other lighting professional organizations are starting to work on.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Is there a packet, Todd, that homeowners and community members can get so that they can have something to go in and talk to their decision makers in their communities?
And we just have a minute or so for your answer.
Right, yeah. So there are on the website, so you've already been out at darksky.org. And if you just go there at the top of the website, you'll see the Get Involved button. There's some ways for you to get involved directly. But then there are also, if you go under the What We Do button, you'll see some nice icons there about dark sky approved lighting and advancing responsible outdoor lighting. One of the key things we always talk about is what we call the five pillars of responsible outdoor lighting. And just very briefly, it does that light serve a purpose? If not, as we talked about earlier, turn it off, whether that's the front porch or that lonely street light that has no one under it all night. The light should be no brighter than it needs to be. We certainly want light so that we can find our way into the house, down the sidewalk, up those front stairs, what have you. But think about how bright that light actually needs to be. And then light trespasses is something we talk a lot about in terms of how your light is shining in your neighbor's yard and vice versa. And then the color temperature, again, that blue versus amber color. The bluer it is, the more harmful it is to both the humans and the natural environment. So these are some very simple things that we can do in our homes. Even if we tell people one of the simplest things to do is close your shades at night. Keep that indoor light indoors. It's absolutely free to just keep that light indoors rather than letting it shine outdoors and go to lighting the outdoor environment or the neighbor's yard or what have you. So very low-cost, no-cost ways that each of us can go home tonight and make a difference.
Very good. Your website address is darksky.org. We encourage people to explore that and learn more about this. And Todd Burlett, it was great to have you on the morning show today. We're glad we connected with you, and we thank you for the good work that you're doing on this really important issue. Thanks again for being part of the morning show today.
Well, thank you. It was just a delight to be here.
All right. Best wishes. All right. Great. What a great conversation. Nan Calvert, quickly, I know you have a couple of announcements for us.
Yes, I just want to give a heads up to the Geneva Lake Dark Sky Initiative. It's a broad-based community movement committed to raising awareness about light pollution in the Geneva Lake area, or as we all call it, Lake Geneva. The initiative is designed to educate about the adverse effects of light pollution and its simple solutions. We can see the stars more vibrantly by implementing sustainable and intelligent light sources in the Geneva Lake area. And so I think you should go to the website, just Google Geneva Lake Dark Sky Initiative, read about what they're doing, and start talking about it. You know, get all of our communities to get involved in initiatives and movements like this. Now, Pringle Nature Center is having an invasive species workday on September 23rd from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. So if you're looking for service hours or you're just interested in helping preserve native habitats, you should join them. It's always on the fourth Saturday of each month, April through October. Volunteers will assist the staff with removing invasive plants around the Nature Center. Tools are provided, but bring your own gloves if possible. No registration is required. Come and leave as you like. If you want more information, just get hold of Pringle Nature Center. And then Hawthorne Hollow is offering a class called Beekeeping 101 on Sunday, September 17th. You can learn all about beekeeping basics with Hawthorne Hollow's beekeeper. You'll learn about the life of a honeybee through the seasons, dive into the supplies and tools needed for the trade, and have a chance to get hands-on in the beehives. You do have to register on the website. The price is $37 in total.
Very good.
Excellent.
Great. Nan Calvert, thank you for all of that, and thank you for arranging what turned out to be a really wonderful morning show interview today.
Yes, thank you so much.
We'll look forward to seeing you in October. Our weather forecast is for a yet another sunny day with a high temperature of 69 degrees, clear overnight with a low of 53, sunny tomorrow and a high of 76. A few clouds rolling in on Saturday with a 40% chance of rain and a high of 72. Sunshine should return Sunday into early next week. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio for classical music programming. Dave McGrath will be back at 12 noon with an update of news on midday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News.